Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
My guest today is Professor Robert Priest, the G.W. Aldeen Professor of International Studies and Professor of Mission and Anthropology at Trinity Evangelical Divinity School in Illinois. He serves as Vice President on the boards of both the American Society of Missiology and the Evangelical Missiological Society, and has also edited several books, including This Side of Heaven, Race, Ethnicity, and Christian Faith. As usual, we will have links to his website and books over at Research on Religion, so please check those out. And don't forget to like us on our Facebook fan page, as we are almost up to 450 followers, and we want to keep that momentum going to reach the 500 level by spring. Each week, you will receive a promotional picture for that week's episode that has been lovingly handcrafted by me. Share this with your friends and be all the envy of folks on Facebook. Bob, welcome to Research on Religion.
Good morning, Tony.
Our topic today is going to be witchcraft and witchcraft accusations more specifically, and that will be in Africa, a topic that I thought might spice things up from our normal fare here on the show. But I have to ask, as I was looking into your curriculum vitae, I see you've done work on missions in Latin America, religious conversion, missionary funding, and you even have some stuff there on megachurches and missiology. I mean, how did you ever end up studying witchcraft in Africa?
Well, I'm an anthropologist, and of course, witchcraft is kind of the bread and butter topic in anthropology. I first encountered a society with witch accusations in northern Peru. So my field work in the late 1980s among the Aguaruna of northern Peru was a society that I learned very quickly that every death from drowning, from snake bite, from tuberculosis, traditionally every death was understood as caused by a neighbor, a relative, a colleague that they called a tunchi, a witch, and this is a feuding society that insisted every death be avenged, so there was also very high levels of witch killing. So I very early got interested in a topic that anthropologists had discovered not in every culture in the world, but in many cultures around the world, and have worked that into my lectures and including on Salem, Massachusetts, and other kinds of things. And then I've had, over the years, more and more doctoral students from Africa, either missionaries or Nigerians, Kenyans, Ghanaians, where they've had a strong interest in this, and they've been reporting some of what's happening in their part of the world. And so as I've started to coach people in dissertations, and as I have increasingly traveled in Africa, I keep asking everybody I meet. I met a high court judge. I'll just end with this short story. I met a high court judge a couple of years ago, Christine Mioli, in Nairobi at a church. I asked her about her last month as a high court judge, what kind of court cases she had. She told me, in the last month, she had had 10 murder trials, all of young men who had killed their father or grandfather, accusing them of being witches. I probed a little more. She said, well, they had misfortunes, financial setbacks, a child die, various misfortunes. They went to a local diviner. The diviner informed them it was their father or grandfather who did who caused this. And so they, in this case, have killed their father or grandfather as a witch. So I've been in Africa, I've been finding in Nigeria, in different places, very different patterns. Some places old women, some places old men, often young children And so this is, along with my students that have started to get interested and do research on it, it's triggered a lot of interest on my part.
Did I hear you correctly, and you said that the study of witchcraft or witches is normal fare in anthropology? I don't know anthropology very much, so are there a lot of people studying this topic?
Sure. This is just one of the top... When anthropologists scattered around the world, they found some cultures that when bad things happen, they're kind of like Job's comforters in the Bible. Bad things happen, and everybody says, oh, you must have been really bad for these bad things to happen, maybe in an earlier life, so kind of a moral causal ontology. But much more common as you go in small-scale, face-to-face societies around the world, the most common answer when a lot of bad things happen is some kind of explanation in terms of evil eye, sorcery, magic, psychic power, but where essentially people are naming a neighbor, relative, colleague, someone as the cause of the misfortune and as the root of the problem. So this is a very common pattern. A lot of the earliest anthropologists wrote about it, and it continues to be a topic that's standard fare in anthropology.
That is absolutely fascinating, because you think different cultures separated by large bodies of water and mountains and just other large, vast areas of spaces would really behave differently. But these commonalities across cultures really must inform us something about the human condition or human nature in some respect.
Sure. So it's not in every, you know, you've got in Native North and South America, many groups have versions of witch accusations. Not all. Some hunter-gatherer groups would not, for example. Africa, most societies historically, but not all. The Maasai would be an example of a pastoralist group that does not historically have this. New Guinea, this would be something that's been there. Some parts of Oceania, no. Korea, no. So it just varies by region of the world. But also every region of the world, almost every region of the world, has historically had versions of this.
I would guess Antarctica is off the list, too, since the penguins are probably not into that. But the question of witches, I'm assuming that many of my guests who are listening to the show, or many of my listeners who are listening to the show, when you hear the word witch, you start to think of the quintessential Halloween figure, the old lady with the long crooked nose, wearing the black hat, riding a broom. But that is not necessarily what we're always dealing with here, is it? I mean, what is a witch, and how would one, say, walking down the street in Africa, see, oh my gosh, that looks like a witch, or somebody make an accusation that that person's a witch? What is the definitional idea behind this witch stuff?
Okay, that's one of the difficulties with even doing research and writing on this. Words mean different things in different settings. I grew up overseas. I loved football. I came to the United States. My cousins loved football. And I thought we had something in common, and then I discovered football in their language was different from football in mine. We were talking about two different things. The word witch functions in that way. So for many in the U.S., neo-pagans, Wiccans, I have a relative that would identify as a witch. She's Wiccan. Her first principle is first do no harm. So here's people self-identifying as part of a new religious movement. They might claim that they have something in common with the people accused in Salem, but probably historians would say they don't really have a lot in common. So witch can be that sort of a thing. But what anthropologists discovered in a lot of societies was that people had a term, Tunchi, Wachawi, different languages would have different words with slightly different meanings, but for someone who it was claimed was the cause of misfortune in someone else's life. So the term being used for someone who caused misfortune in the life of another, acting through evil occult means. So characteristically, this person was defined as someone antisocial, the inverse of all moral sentiments and so on. So a lot of cultures had this. Some of them explained the power in psychic terms. You might not even know you were a witch. Some cultures stressed that you were apprenticed, kind of more of a sorcery, magic that you learn in order to harm others. Some it's the evil eye. So you get some variability there. When I'm using the term, I'm primarily using it then in that older anthropological sense of the category that's an attributed category to people that are thought of as the cause of misfortune. And it's the one other clarification is today in the modern world, in Africa, under the influence of churches, Pentecostal churches and so on, in English, people will often take the word witch and they'll use that both for the word that in the earlier language was used for quote-unquote witch, and the word that we might translate shaman or diviner, witch doctor, whatever. And so sometimes in contemporary usage, people will just use witch for all any kind of anything magical, religious, that's not Christian. The piece I'm focusing specifically on is in most of these cultures, traditionally, is this notion that there are certain people who are the cause of the misfortune in the lives of others.
Now, this is very interesting because some people do identify as a witch. They say, I'm a Wiccan, and that becomes their identity. But what you're talking about here and what your focus of the study that you're conducting is that people are accused of this, that they might not self-identify as a witch, but all of a sudden somebody says, you have given me the evil eye. Why focus on the witchcraft accusations? Why is that your specific interest? And tell us a little bit about this research initiative that you're doing.
Sure. There are consequences to the accusation. In the case of the people I did field work with, the Aguaruna, you have one of the highest homicide rates in the world, as studied by Michael Brown. He gives statistics on this, very, very high homicide rates. The vast majority of those are related to witch suspicions and accusations. So essentially, to be accused of being a witch is to be accused of being a murderer, for example. And so it's a pretty consequential accusation, and plays out in very consequential ways in the lives of often old women, old widows, in the lives of orphans, in the lives of the elderly, in marrying strangers into a community, and so on.
We're going to talk a little bit about those consequences and in just a few minutes here, but there's something very interesting. We're living in a contemporary era that has the internet, the lots of science and stuff. And when I think of witchcraft accusations, I tend to think of the Salem witch trials or the various witch hunts that were scattered across medieval European history. And it seems to be a very pre-modern type of accusation or type of behavior. We're going to accuse you of being a witch because the apples on your tree didn't grow this year, and so we're going to blame somebody else. Wouldn't we expect that this superstitious kind of phenomena would only diminish as societies modernize? Why is this stuff still lingering?
Okay, that's a very important question. Of course, in Europe, we had a period of time where the historians are now claiming something in the neighborhood of 90,000 people were tried in judicial cases as witches, and maybe half of those put to death, the majority by burning. So we have our own history, but I asked my seminary students here in the United States, how many of your colleagues, relatives, or neighbors do you personally know who've been accused of harming someone through witchcraft? And the only two of a large class of students that knew, that said yes, they knew someone, put in footnotes saying it was while I lived overseas. So we don't, in our world, associate this with the present. If you ask that in a seminary classroom in Kenya, which I've done, the vast majority of people will say, I have only a tiny minority, probably 10 to 15%, will say, I don't have a relative, colleague, or neighbor who's been accused of being a murderer through witchcraft. But the majority will say they have many.
Wow, now, that's 85%. That's big. That's a huge percentage.
That's a huge percent.
Wow.
And depending on your group, if you're Kamba, for example, in Kenya, about a quarter of the Kamba will say, in my family, there are six or more who've been accused of murder through witchcraft. And if you just ask accused of doing other things through witchcraft, it rises much higher. So the rates are high. Anthropologists thought that witchcraft was part of old traditional cultures and would be dying out. And so for a while, witchcraft accusations kind of moved off the center of anything that anthropologists were researching. But more recently, anthropologists have been impressed with the fact that this is an exploding phenomenon. And they write about what they call the modernity of witchcraft, where they're saying it's not just in village settings, it's in urban settings, it's in the townships of South Africa, and that in fact there are new patterns emerging that have some continuity with the past, but also are looking quite different from the past with a great deal of energy that was not there in the past. When I interviewed several older church leaders, both in Nigeria and Kenya, one of the things they told me is when we were young people in our churches, we hardly had anybody ever accuse somebody else of being a witch. Now in our churches, this is going on all the time. So it seems to have become a looming issue, pastorally speaking, in these churches all across Africa, New Guinea, and some other places.
That is rather interesting, because I was going to press you on a methodological issue here. And what I hear you telling me is that the subjects that you talk to are confirming that this is an exploding phenomenon. If you look back in the past, we haven't seen it very much, but now we see it much more frequently. My question that I was going to have for you, and this is a methodological question, is how do we know that this exploding phenomena, the rate of increase in witchcraft accusations, is not merely an effect of anthropologists going out and looking for it? There's always that measurement effect, right? We don't know a certain disease exists until we define it, then all of a sudden it seems to explode on the scene, but in reality it might have been there all along. How do you figure out that, yeah, this really is an exploding trend, versus do we just start looking for it and finding it more now?
Well, I mean, what I would say is within churches in Africa, the kinds of evidence I just talked about would be one sort of evidence, that is, Yusufu Turaki, I mean, various esteemed church leaders are themselves expressing how within the lives of churches this has become much more central. And there's some things that have happened within Christianity that have, I think, contributed to that. There's Adam Ashforth in South Africa. Part of his explanation is that under apartheid, and maybe in other places under colonialism, you had other ideologies that explained economic misfortune and other kinds of misfortune. And that once that was passed, once you no longer have an explanation of racism and so on as the reason for great poverty, then in Adam Ashforth's argument, then the witch ideology again looms as more central to explain. It's a great question that you're asking, and I guess I would have to think further about how to address it.
Yeah.
For instance, if you go to Ghana, and if listeners are interested in this, there's a marvelous film, The Witches of Gambaga, put together by a Ghanaian filmmaker, Yaba Bado. And this is in an area where when mainly older women are accused of being witches, often they're being beaten. Maybe they sacrifice a chicken to see which way it falls, and that'll show for sure whether they're a witch. they escaped their lives to some villages in northern Ghana, including Gambaga, that are kind of like cities of refuge in the Old Testament. You go there and you're safe, and the chief supposedly has the power to neutralize your witchcraft. So you have got these villages of 1,000 or more witches, accused witches, living. And even in the period of time that Yaba Badeau was doing her her film, if I recall correctly, it went from 1,000 to 2,500 or 3,000 of these people over a several-year period where this was. So even though civil rights people and others are saying, let's close these camps, there's an expansion of people in the camps.
Fascinating to hear all about this, because I haven't heard much about this. We'll make sure that we link to that film on our website so that our listeners can check it out if they're more interested in this stuff. Let's get into the topic of what these accusations are and start off by talking about what witches are accused of doing. We already mentioned that a common one seems to be murder, but are there other things that pop up on the radar that people do that seem to be attributed to witchcraft, you know, somebody's crops fail or things like that? Are there any other patterns that we're witnessing in terms of what these accusations are about?
Sure. I surveyed again 160 graduate students and faculty at Africa International University. And one of my questions was, how many people told you that they suspect a witch harmed them by causing? And if it was financial problems, 91% of respondents said had one or more people attribute. This is a smaller sample for this particular question. So about 30 mainly graduate school students and faculty, but 91% say I've had other people say that my financial problems are caused by a witch, with 18% of them saying I've had at least 21 people tell me their financial problems were caused by this. Infertility was not as high. 62% say I've had other people tell me that their infertility was caused, that they suspect their infertility was caused by a witch. It was about 8% saying I've had 21 or more people tell me that. Health problems, 95% of respondents say I've had one or more people tell me that their health problem is due to witchcraft, with 36%, so fully a third. Now, these are theological leaders from across Africa. Fully a third say I've had 21 or more people tell me that their illness was caused by witchcraft. 91% say the death of a child or family member was caused by witchcraft. So these are just some of the most common areas.
Are there any patterns? Actually, let me stop before I ask that question. I am interested in your methodology for doing this. You talk to graduate students and ask them if they heard other people mentioning this. And I know some people in the audience might say, oh, that doesn't sound like it's a really sound methodology. Actually, it's very clever, because I would imagine that this is difficult, a topic that is difficult to study by just going somebody directly and say, are you a witch? Have you done witchcraft? Or alternatively, do you think your neighbor over there is engaging in witchcraft? There's this little indirect method of figuring things out that survey researchers often do that I think is rather clever, that helps us sift out a lot of reluctance to answer questions certain ways. Was that your intent here?
Yeah, historically anthropologists have done work through participant observation, and that was where my own doctoral work was done, with the Aguaruna. So there I wasn't asking survey questions, trying to develop quantitative material. So one way to do research, and the place where the majority of research has been done, has been qualitative, especially at funerals. Whenever there's a funeral within some cultures, that's precisely what's at stake, is who caused this. You might apprentice yourself to a traditional diviner, and in that context you're going to hear an awful lot about how diviners are interpreting the afflictions as due to witchcraft. So there's a lot of that in the literature, but it's kind of culture by culture. It's ethnographic. It's not quantitative. So here I was trying to come up with a way to say, look, we've got a pool of people from all different ethnic groups. So we asked about their ethnic group as well, so we can compare the Kikuyu versus the Kamba versus the Luo. And just ask them about what their family and relatives who've been accused and what people have told them. So it becomes one way of getting at evidence.
So given that, are there any patterns that arise in terms of these accusations based upon regions that you've studied or perhaps demography? Are there certain people more likely to be accused of witchcraft because they happen to be older, because they happen to be younger, or, you know, certain types of regional variation that occurs that, these folks really focus on witchcraft because of financial problems. These folks focus on witchcraft because of infertility.
Yeah, there's variability on some things. Gender is one area. In Europe, about 80% of the people put to death as witches were women, is what the historians are now claiming. Although in some regions, it would be almost all men. The people that I did field work with in the Aguaruna believed only men could do this. So that was kind of an unusual outlier. Again, children in traditional cultures are not as commonly accused, although near where I was in Peru, the Machigenga, mainly children and female children and orphans were accused. If you're looking at the overall patterns, one of the patterns is anybody that is a have-not. So the witch is someone who is envious, who is unhappy about the well-being and success of others. So since that's one of the core traits that you identify with witchcraft, part of what it means is anybody who's experiencing particular misfortune. If you're crippled, if you're blind, if you're handicapped, if you're an elderly widow in a world without Social Security, if you're an old man, if you're an in-marrying person into the community and then your husband dies, even pastors can be accused. If you were looking at one of the main patterns is that elderly, widows, orphans, this is a new exploding phenomenon in much of Africa, West Africa, Malawi, Angola, and so on, is the new trend to accuse children, 6-year-old boys, for example, of being witches. Often these are children whose own parents have died, which suggests that this is kind of an inversion of why should healthy parents die when the child live. And then in-laws take them in, maybe somebody else gets sick or dies. And so children are being accused at very high rates. So that would be another pattern. Sometimes pastors. I spoke with one Nigerian head of an orphanage, Haruna Tukura, and he described a rather large orphanage, and he said that somewhere between 25% and 40% was his estimate of the children that come to their orphanage are rescued from being accused of being witches. And he just had horror stories on how they had been treated, burned, and branded, and other things to try and drive the witchcraft out of them.
There's a little bit of a catch-22 almost to this when you say that the have-nots are people who've had misfortune, they've just been widowed, they've just been orphaned. They're the ones being accused of witchcraft, but one could almost say, hey, their misfortune was caused by other witches. There's a little bit of a catch-22 there, if I'm correct in observing this.
Sure. I mean, that would certainly be a part of it.
Let me turn to the consequences of some of these accusations. You've already hinted about it, that some people getting burned and things like that. What are some of the consequences facing those accused with witchcraft? I mean, do they just pay a fine and, you know, you're done with it, here's $300 and move along, or are there things more serious? It seems like there are things more serious here.
There's a wide continuum. I talked with one professor, John Jusu, and he describes as a child, he says, everybody in the village said such and such a woman was a witch and had caused all kinds of bad things. He said she was an old woman, she was a widow, she had one chicken, and that chicken laid one egg every day. That's where she got her protein. He said, but we were a bunch of teenagers, and we felt that she was a witch, and the whole community agreed that it was okay for us to kill her chicken and eat it.
Oh.
So we took her. So, you know, it's not, in that case, she wasn't put to death, nothing, but just microaggressions, but pretty consequential. But he also described the story when he was a child watching a group of teenagers. So the community, kind of the moral leaders of the community weren't doing the killing, but the moral leaders of the community all said so-and-so was a witch, and a group of teenage boys killed a woman, threw her into the river.
Mm.
If you look at the patterns of what, so I with the 160 graduate students and faculty, I said, okay, of the 92% of you that know someone that was accused of harming others through witchcraft, which of the following happened to the people you knew, the neighbors, relatives, colleagues you knew that others accused? And 84% said they were shunned or voided. Now, if you're an orphan, if you're a widow without Social Security, the one thing you need is a world that's willing to help out. So this, it can be pretty consequential.
50, yeah, I would say, too, I have to break in. You mentioned that the killing of the chicken was a microaggression, but, you know, for a woman who only has one chicken and the source of her daily protein is this one egg that the chicken lays, that can be very consequential. Doesn't
it? Well, you're right. Yeah, I probably shouldn't use that kind of language.
But I understand, you know, why people would say that. Say, well, we're not going to go directly attack the person, but we'll damage something in their house or we'll take away something. And sometimes that can be pretty severe, I would imagine.
Right. So there's all, what I would say is the evidence is there's a lot of those kinds of things happening. Then the more serious, 52% of my respondents say, I know a neighbor, relative, or colleague that was accused that was physically attacked and beaten up. 47% say, I know a relative, neighbor, or colleague that was accused whose property was taken, whose house was burned or destroyed, so the property taken or destroyed. 47% say, one of the people I knew, at least one, was driven from home or community. 34% say, one or more of the neighbors, relatives, colleagues I knew that was accused of this were killed. In the survey there in Kenya, only 12% said jailed. Most African countries don't prosecute and put in jail, but there's a few that do, like Central African Republic. So if I had done the survey there, I suspect the numbers would have been much higher on the jail side. The same survey, a former student of mine carried out in the Congo with a group of 40 older pastors, and I think 100% of them said they knew neighbors, relatives, or colleagues who had been killed as witches. So this varies from place to place, but it's pretty consequential.
Have you noticed any correlations between the type of accusation and the punishment? I would imagine the old eye for an eye might be at play here. If you're accused of murder, they're probably going to come after you physically, but if you're just accused of some small financial misfortune, well, we take away a chicken or two. Have you noticed any correlation there?
That's a great question. I don't have good data on that, no.
Okay. Well, that's something out there for you or other graduate students to dig into. So we love always suggesting research projects here on the region. I would imagine that would be the case, though, right? If it's the
it makes perfect sense.
Yeah, the accusation's pretty minor. You would think that the fine is going to be pretty minor, and if it's something as severe as the murder of a relative that the witch is being accused of, that's not going to bode well for you. I'd probably want to get out of Dodge.
Right, right.
I want to shift gears here a little bit because your background, as we mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, is on missiology, on largely Christianity, mission funding, and things like that. So Christianity and the study of Christianity is your wheelhouse here. And we know that Christianity, especially Pentecostalism, evangelical Christianity, has really been expanding quickly across Africa. Has Christianity itself been implicated in any of the witchcraft accusations that are going on today?
Yeah, and that's been part of my interest, is that Christian institutions, Christian leaders themselves have often become pivotal to the defense of the very idea that these things are happening because of witches. You'll remember in our own American history that Cotton Mather was probably pretty central in his writings a few years before Salem in contributing to the ratification and justification of using spectral evidence and the whole series of things there. So you get, in Europe, you got set of folk ideas that neighbors might be bringing harm, and then you had theologians trying to bring theological ideas about the devil, Satan, and merge it, if you please, with some of the other. And so you then get potentially Christianity becoming the new carriers of witch ideologies. And I there are places, like with the Sukuma of Tanzania, where it's the traditional diviners, huge numbers of traditional diviners, with 50% of the diviners, 50% of the sickness that's brought to the diviner, the diviner says a neighbor, relative, or colleague did it to you. So witchcraft, 50%. So just 100 times as many diviners as medical doctors. That's where people go when they're sick, and the diviners are cranking out an interpretation that one of your neighbors did this to you. In other parts of Africa, you have Christianity, the diviners, the quote-unquote witch doctors, are no longer there. Everybody's quote-unquote Christian, but you get versions of diviners who are kind of Christian prophets who are doing some of the same things. And it's really tough from the standpoint of Christian understandings to figure out how do we put this together. So even Christians who are not central to ratifying this are nonetheless struggling with it and trying to make sense of it. A majority of Christians in Africa regularly pray that God would protect them from witches, at least in small surveys I've done so far. So it really is a different religious world, even for Christians, in some of these places that I don't think we've been looking at closely enough.
That is very interesting, because you know the old Christian saying, love thy neighbor as yourself, but it doesn't have a clause afterwards, love your neighbor as yourself, but if they're a witch, go ahead and accuse them. I mean, that's not there, right? So that's interesting that Christians are accusing people of witchcraft. I would have also thought that the causal direction might go in reverse, because Pentecostalism, fairly new religion historically in Africa, now sweeping across the continent like wildfire, they, you know, kind of do some crazy things sometimes. There's a lot of singing and clapping and hand throwing and speaking in tongues. It would almost seem that some of these Pentecostals are setting themselves up to be accused of witches, not only being some of the accusers.
Yeah, and it's the kind of thing where we had a conference on this topic in Kenya this last year, and are planning another one with about 50 theological leaders from across Africa, 40, I forget the exact number. And one of the most engaged sessions had to do with the fact that pastors are often accused of being witches. Mm-hmm. One of the cases that one of my own doctoral students, Max Gaya, presented was of a pastor he had known well, an older man. There was a baptism a young woman going into baptism. As she hits the baptismal water, she starts screaming and points at the senior pastor and says, "He's a witch. I saw him with the witches." And a long process where eventually the church decided he was a witch, and they removed him, removed his retirement benefits and all the rest. So this generated at our conference enormous energy and debate, partly because of the participants at our conference, 40-something percent of them knew pastors who had been accused of being witches. So it certainly can spill out in those directions as well.
How do these things play out? Because you just mentioned this pastor was accused of being a witch during this specific moment in time, just doing a baptism, and out of the blue, the person rises up, says, "You're a witch." Yeah, I know that the pastorate is a very vulnerable profession. You're always susceptible to various accusations, especially when you're doing private consulting. And, there's a great deal of talk about how to manage that in pastoral care here in the United States. But such vulnerabilities can really affect the pastorate. And one would have to, think about how do we protect ourselves from this? And are there any cases where people are accused of witches, a pastor being accused of a witch, and then everybody says, "No, come on, this guy's a really good guy. Let him off the hook. We know that this claim is just somebody aggravated with the church singing too loud on Sunday or something." Do people get off from these accusations?
Yeah, there's always, there's social processes involved, and it involves gossip, it involves kind of the moral process of bringing a consensus in a certain direction, whispered stories about what people do and don't remember. And sometimes if a person accused has the most kind of the morally central people of the community discounting it, then it's not likely to go very far. But often, I have another former doctoral student, Dr. Timothy Nyasulu, who's now moderator of the largest Presbyterian church in Africa in Malawi, and he has cases where a pastor is accused, and every other pastor knows if we defend him, then we become the next candidate to be accused. We're defending the witches. When I was doing my own field work with the Aguaruna, that was one of the things I noticed, was whenever bad things have happened with the Aguaruna, everybody wants to figure out who the witch is, and therefore it's in everyone's interest if the consensus goes in a different direction other than you.
Yeah, that can be a really bad social dynamic, I guess.
I'm reminded in faculty meetings. I was in a school where every year the dean would appoint a new secretary for the, and he would always appoint young faculty with kids and just learning the ropes. And it was interesting to me that none of the other faculty ever went to their defense saying, "Oh no, they've got kids, and why are we adding this extra thing on them?" Because if any faculty member had defended them, they would have been seen as volunteering. So even though it's a seminary, godly faculty, nobody defends a poor person being appointed as. And in some ways, there were similar patterns with the Aguaruna. Once the consensus starts to move in a certain direction, it's very hard for other people to fight against it without raising the possibility that you yourself are in league with these witches and really are one yourself. So it's a difficult area. Some people, Opoku Onyina is the head of the Association of Pentecostal Churches in Ghana. He has a level of authority and respect, and he's one of the few African church leaders who's done an incredible amount of research, and pretty good research on these witch accusations, has published in this area. And he just goes to bat all over the place for the accused, and he just claims to be more knowledgeable than other people, and no, this is not a witch, and he seems to be pretty successful at pulling it off.
I just have to rewind the tape here a little bit, and if I heard you correctly, you say that faculty in colleges and universities might be susceptible to our own little witchcraft trials and things like that as well. And oh my gosh, this is really popping my bubble here. I thought us academics were above the fray of everything we study, but I guess we're human after all, are we not?
The question is, are we willing to put our own well-being on the line in defense of someone else, especially since you don't know? I mean, that's the whole difficulty is here.
Yeah.
From the standpoint subjectively, is maybe they are. Maybe they are. So how do we know they're not? So when I surveyed this 160 people there in Nairobi, 70% of them, when I asked, of the people that you knew who were accused, to what extent do you think some of those were falsely accused? 70% said, yeah, at least some of those that were accused, I don't think really were a witch. So there's a pretty broad consensus that there can be false accusations. People chuckle when they start looking at how the accusations play out. If the diviner is the one that says they're a witch, should we be accepting the claims of the diviner? If in the Sukuma, if you're a woman with red eyes, you've been cooking over the fire, that's the marker that you're a witch. If your eyes are runny, your nose is runny, I said to the group, like, do you have allergies? And they laughed and said, yeah, like allergies. Then that's the marker that you're a witch. In the coast of Kenya, if your hair turns white, then that would show you're a witch. So the joke is people are buying hair dye so that people won't know they're a witch. In Nigeria, I was told that if a woman has whiskers on her chin, that's a possible sign that she's a witch. We did the same thing in Europe and North America. We had, if you had a mole on your body, that could be the witch's teat. If you had a part of your body when you stick a needle in it and it doesn't hurt, that could show you're a witch. I have one of those parts on my body, by the way. For those kinds of things, a lot of the educated Kenyans and so on that I was talking with chuckle and laugh and discount those things, but they know that those are part at the folk level of what's going on, and so there's an awareness that a lot of this should not be trusted, but there's also a tendency to believe that this is that some people really do have the power to, through evil supernatural means, to cause death and affliction in the lives of other people.
I want to bring this back around to the role of Christianity in the region, because, again, you have such a interesting background that the intersection of these different streams of anthropology come together very well. And I should mention that you are not just a social scientist, but you work at a divinity school. Thus, you have a great deal of crossover with theologians and how theology has practical applications out there in the field, particularly with respects to missions, which is one of your fields of expertise. So I'm going to ask you this. To what extent does the Bible itself help inform the underpinnings or perhaps rationale for witchcraft accusations and the resultant violence that we see? Is it something that prods people forward? Is it something that pulls the rein back? How does this play out with Christians in the region?
Wow, that moves us in several different directions. One is, we could ask the question, does the Bible itself endorse the idea that when bad things happen, it is sometimes because other people did it, acting through evil occult means? And I would argue there's not a single place in the Bible where that idea is even present, much less endorsed. So that you have more of a moral causal ontology. Job's comforters all agree 100% that if something bad happens to you, it's because you did something bad. The people I did field work with would never have said that. They would if they had written the book of Job with the Agudah, and it would have been 42 chapters talking about how someone envied you, a neighbor, relevant, who did this to you would have been the primary question. So my own personal take is that there's discontinuities rather than continuities. But the way the Bible has been understood and translated, the one place that's been very influential is that when the Bible is translated, especially the Exodus, 22:18, where it says, "You shall not allow a kashaf to live," would be the Hebrew, has been understood in the English translations, "You shall not allow a witch or sorceress to live." That has been understood, has been translated into all different African languages using the indigenous term for this ascribed category. There's a secret person out there. Keep in mind, there's a difference between doing research on the subject of a pastor. You can go interview a pastor. You can interview a shaman. You can interview, you know, these are public identities. People accept them. They embrace them. The witch category is an attributed identity. And so its starting point is really an explanation of misfortune and so on. Occasionally people confess under certain conditions and so on, but for the most part it's just a different sort of thing. When people read in Swahili the Exodus translation, "You shall not allow a woman witch to live," they understand that the Bible is endorsing the idea that that murderers are loose in our land and we need to get rid of them. So this is seen as an endorsement. Of course, if you read the Bible in Korean or Chinese, your Bible doesn't say that because the Koreans didn't have that category. They had the mudang. The mudang is a medium. She contacts the dead and so on, but nobody attributes misfortune to her. So it's a public category. You can interview her. You can watch her at work and so on. And when the Korean reads their Bible, there's not a witch in the Bible. Whereas when Africans are reading it, closely related to that, so partly my argument that I'm trying to have with some biblical scholars is we've probably been mistranslating and misinterpreting even the kashaf passage. The only place in the Old Testament where we know what that word means in terms of who it's used of is Exodus 7:11 and Daniel 2:2, where Pharaoh says, "I have a bunch of religious professionals, and let's see if they can do what Moses did. Call for my kashaf." And Nebuchadnezzar in Daniel 2:2 says, "I have a bunch of religious professionals, and let's see if they can divine a dream. Call for his kashaf." Kashaf in those two places don't fit what anthropologists would say is the witch category. They fit the witch doctor category, or the diviner, or the power worker, or the wonder worker. So I have personally questions whether that translation has been handled well. But it's also the case that in most African cultures, historically, you had an idea of a high god, but you didn't have an idea of a Satan figure, of Satan as the absolute antithesis of God and the good. And so the moral discourses of most cultures with witch ontologies makes the symbolic focus of evil is the image of the witch, of the person, of the witch, a neighbor, relative, or colleague. And then you merge two different symbol systems coming together, and there's a tendency then to where all language of evil is kind of a witch-inflected language of evil. And in some cases, in Ghana, for example, with I think the Akan, the very word that the missionaries used to translate Satan was a word that literally just meant witch. So you get this fusion. So now every time people read their Bible, it looks like it's filled with witches, and that Satan and witches are tied closely together and so on. So there's a fusion of two different things in a way which then comes for Christians in that part of the world to feel like this is simply a Christian idea. When human rights workers are trying to fight against witchcraft in Malawi or Nigeria, it's often been the British Association of Secular Humanism or whatever that has led that, and so it pits Christianity against. So it becomes almost like Cotton Mather's concern to fight against atheism and so thus defend witchcraft. I've got in front of me the headlines of a newspaper article in Malawi where Norway had just given 207 million kwacha, $500,000, to the Association for Secular Humanism in Malawi in order to combat witchcraft. But the headline says, Norway pumps 207 million kwacha into atheists' anti-witchcraft yards. So the very newspaper locates this as a theism versus atheism thing. You may or may not remember that John Wesley at one point said, to disbelieve in witches is to disbelieve in God. So for some Christians, the two have been fused in such a way that you almost feel like faithfulness to being Christian is that we agree that, yes, the reason bad things are happening is because there are witches in our midst.
You mentioned that this is a heightened awareness among anthropologists and increasingly pastors and such. And since you work in the missiology field, you're very aware how missionaries organize and how pastors in the field out there organize. Is there growing efforts to study this or to deal with this, I should say, systematically as missionaries or as pastors? Or is this something that's just on the table, people talk about on the side at conferences? Or are there missions conferences, conferences of Christians in Africa that are taking this issue head on?
Yeah, there's some of us that are just starting to do this. We had a conference last a year ago in Nairobi, and then networks of people even within that are involved in efforts to engage. Let me just give two or three examples of how this plays out. The first observation is non-Africans are not in a good position to come in and claim to have the answers. They simply lack credibility. So part of in an African context, a lot of African countries, Christian pastors who are African have a lot of cognitive authority. And so just as in Salem, Massachusetts, those Boston ministers not only had the power to contribute to the problem, but they were the one category of person that really had the cognitive authority to make a difference. I would argue that something similar is going on. So at best, what's needed in Africa with outsiders involved, like myself, is partnership relations where we're working together with a variety of people. John, two or three examples. One of my former doctoral students, Steve Rasmussen, has been working with the Sukuma of Tanzania. And this is an area where human rights people claim that in Tanzania as many as 500 people, mainly older women, are killed, lynched as witches each year. Steve's been concerned. He's worked with his graduate students from Nairobi, one of whom is Joshua Lusato, a Bible school principal in Tanzania. And Joshua, part of our conviction is the closer you get to the phenomenon of witch accusation and the people being accused, and the more, not just listening to gossip, kind of urban legend stories, but the closer you get to case after case after case as it plays out, the more you're likely to shift in your understandings. And so Joshua, whose wife is a lawyer, the two of them went to the police station with the little funding that we helped provide in Mwanza, and over 5 years looked at police records and were able to discover in this region 87 women per year that had been lynched, killed as witches. He then went out. He was in one community where he found there had been 6 women that had been killed over the last 5 years. When he got their names and ran them against the police records, they weren't even in the police records. So there's fairly high rates in this area. But as Joshua got close to these women, he interviewed women who'd been chopped with machetes and others. He talked with Steve Rasmussen. He started struggling with the possibility that the evil is the evil of those that think they're fighting evil and not simply those they're attributing it to. By the end of Joshua's time, he said, you know, I used to think that if 100 women are accused of being witches, maybe one of them is not a witch. He said, now, he says, I think if 100 women are accused, maybe one of them is a witch. Maybe. And then he helped lead a conference with Steve Rasmussen there in Tanzania, where they got a whole group of people who'd been accused of being witches to tell their stories. They got Catholic leaders, they got others, got a whole group of church leaders that by the end of it were saying, there is an evil here in terms of how these people are being treated. Many of them probably are not what we think they are. The church has got to become involved. It can't just be secular human rights kinds of groups. So there's a fair amount of this going on at grassroots level. John Jussu would be the one other person I'll mention. John Jussu, he points out that as he reads his Bible, it's whenever the poor, whenever the widow, whenever the orphan, whenever the stranger is referred to, we're told these are the people God wants us to love and protect. Mm-hmm. And then he says, and when I look at who's being accused, it is the very people that God has told us the people of God should be protecting. So that in the Bible, every time the widow, the poor, and the orphan are presented, we're supposed to see that treating them with care is like treating Jesus. We should see Jesus in them. But the witch ideology is teaching us to see these people in the image of the devil and so on. And so John Jussu has done a pretty powerful job in his teaching and in other ways to convince people that this is something the church itself has got to take leadership on, and we have got to figure out how to address it. But again, it's not yet worked out very far in terms of research, in terms of curriculum, seminaries, and so on. Just really struggle with how to address it. So it's an area where the church is hugely impactful in terms of people's experience of this. Most pastors are not saying, kill the witches, but many pastors are saying, yeah, they really are witches. Yes, the reason for misfortune is that. Even the act of praying and endorsing the idea that a child that's being accused is a witch, when the pastor endorses it and says, okay, we'll try and exorcise them, sometimes the consequence is that people then, the next time there's a misfortune, say even the pastor agrees that the child is a witch. And so the role of pastors is not primarily, the negative side is not primarily that they're endorsing violence towards people, but simply that they are contributing sometimes to the endorsement of the accusation, and then teenagers do the violence or whatever.
Well, this is certainly a changing landscape at a very interesting point in history here in Africa that we'll have to keep our eye on. And we might have to visit you once again to see how this project develops. And I wanted to thank Bob Priest for being on Research on Religion today.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.